I would think that a return to Suez is still going to take a while. But we've also learned that things can change very, very rapidly. I would not be surprised that if the situation in the Strait gets resolved, that fairly soon thereafter, we will also start looking again at returning to Suez.
Straight Talk with Rolf Habben Jansen.
Hello and welcome to the first in a new series of podcast conversations with Rolf Habben Jansen, Chief Executive of the German shipping group Hapag-Lloyd. My name is Janet Porter and I'm a maritime journalist who has spent many years writing about the container shipping industry. It's a fascinating business, the backbone of global trade, and I never ran out of stories to cover. However, the last few years have been unprecedented in terms of external shocks, from Somali piracy and the COVID pandemic to the invasion of Ukraine, Houthi attacks on commercial shipping, and now the Middle East war and closure of the Strait of Hormuz. That has left hundreds of ships and thousands of seafarers trapped in the Persian Gulf. Now, overnight, there's been some positive news in the shape of Project Freedom and a US promise to escort ships out of the Persian Gulf. So could I start, Rolf, by asking you if you know anything more about this than we've heard in the news this morning and how optimistic you might be that perhaps the crisis could be coming to an end?
I think, in fairness, we also have only read it in the news this morning. I think what is good is that people, you know, continue to look for ways to get the ships out of the Gulf. But as we have seen also with previous announcements, one typically has to wait 24, 48, 72 hours before we will see how it really unfolds. But let's be clear that, you know, we welcome every initiative that's being taken that might help us to get our ships out of the Gulf.
But overall, how does a company like Hapag-Lloyd deal with so many external crises and prepare for the unexpected? I mean, it seems to be every morning you must switch on the radio to hear what the latest is and then think how to respond.
Well, I think we've learned over the last 5-6 years that many unexpected things can happen. And I think we found a good way, meanwhile, to deal with that. And, you know, like you see it here in this case, where once we had the events unfolding between the US, Israel and Iran, I think we established a crisis staff, which now meets every day. And sometimes that's a meeting of 2 minutes and sometimes it takes a little longer. And also all the departments that then need to work with them are meantime very well coordinated. I mean, if you compare that to how we were struggling initially when COVID broke out in 2020, then you can see that we and probably also many others have gotten used to quickly changing environments.
Now, the Strait of Hormuz, I'm guessing this might be the worst crisis of all of the recent ones I listed, but it's effectively been closed for 2 months now. And during that time, much of the focus has been on the tankers and oil exports, but there are dozens of box ships also stranded. Can you tell me what the impact has been on the container trades to and from the region?
Well, the container trade has been very much impacted, of course, because quite a few countries are pretty dependent on container traffic and supplies that come out of all kinds of different parts of the world. When you look today at the volumes that still move into those countries, then it's, of course, a lot less because the ships can't go into the Gulf. The only way to get it in there is via land bridge, either through ports like Khor Fakkan or Fujairah or Salalah or over Jeddah. But of course, the capacity of all those land bridges is a lot less. So the impact of that is quite significant. How much of the global trade it exactly impacts? I think most estimates say it's about 5 or 7%. And of course, that volume today is down with realistically probably somewhere between 60 and 80%.
So are there shortages now in some of the Gulf countries because they can't get maybe foodstuffs or pharmaceuticals or all the sort of goods that arrive in containers?
I mean, so far we have seen very few reports on that, to be fair. So I suspect also that there is a fair bit of stock in most of those countries as they know that they are somewhat vulnerable. Of course, and then as I said, you know, volume is not down to zero, but more like down with 60 to 80% because the rest comes over land bridges. And I assume that what we move there are, of course, the goods that have the highest priority. So all in all, I don't see a lot of shortages at this point in time. But of course, if this situation lasts for a couple more months, then for sure that will also happen.
So can you tell me more about the land bridges? This is trucks or are there railroads in the region and are there sufficient trucks?
I mean, it's mainly trucks, yeah. And of course, there are not sufficient trucks because, you know, the region and the infrastructure is not built for that. And let's not forget that the distances between, say, Khor Fakkan or Fujairah and final destination are pretty long. And even if one could still feed or something via Jebel Ali or so, the landside capacity is just not enough to cope with the amount of cargo that normally gets transported overseas.
Now, you just mentioned Jebel Ali in Dubai. That's one of the world's biggest container ports. It's a huge transshipment hub. Are you now looking ahead and perhaps permanently reconfiguring your trade routes so that you'll be less dependent on Jebel Ali and other ports in the Persian Gulf?
Not yet. I mean, I think we've seen also with other crises that, you know, once the situation returns back to normal, then normal patterns typically also reoccur. So I would still expect that once the situation normalizes and there's a reasonable perspective that it will stay stable, that ports like Jebel Ali, but also the ports in Abu Dhabi, will still be very important because they are simply much more efficient, yeah, than doing it via, say, a Khor Fakkan or Fujairah, which means that then a lot of goods still need to be transported over hundreds of kilometers by truck. And that's just a lot more expensive. And over time, that counts.
I understand. Now, I also understand that you had one ship that managed to escape, but you've still got other ships trapped there. Could you tell me how the seafarers on those ships are coping? Have they got provisions? Have they got fresh water? Have they got access to medical care if they need it? How are you helping them?
Yeah, we're trying to do whatever we can. I think they generally have enough provisions. They have enough fresh water and we can get them supplies from ports like Jebel Ali. So that's not the biggest problem. We also give them, of course, additional facilities in terms of Starlink and internet access and stuff like that. But that doesn't take away that being stuck on a ship in what is essentially a war zone for an extended period of time is, of course, not good. And that's why we work tirelessly day and night to try and find ways to get them out. And that's also where, you know, announcements like they were there yesterday on Project Freedom, we follow those very closely, yeah, as we will take every opportunity that there is to get those people out.
Are any of them able to get ashore and fly home if there was some, you know, family emergency? Are they able to get off the ship?
Yeah, in principle, that is possible. But of course, crew changes are difficult. Yeah? Also because, you know, not that many seafarers are very keen to join those ships, also with the uncertain outlook that we have at the moment.
Can you tell me anything at all about the ship that you did manage to get out?
I mean, what we can tell you is that it was coordinated closely with the authorities and that we felt that it was safe. And in the end, it turned out also to be safe. We won't disclose anything else, also because, you know, whenever there's an opportunity to get something out, one of the ships out, we'll try to take it. And then it's not good to, you know, say too much about how we managed to get them out.
What about the ship and the seafarers on board? I mean, how are they when they got out? Did you have medical assessments? And the ship itself, what sort of condition was that in?
I mean, the ship was in reasonable condition. I think the main surprise we had was actually the amount of fouling we had on the ship, because the ship had been in water of about 30 degrees for 6 to 8 weeks. So then you see that there's a lot of stuff that gets attached to the ship that you really don't want to have attached to the ship. And as such, it needs quite a lot of cleaning. We also noticed that once we got her out, that the maximum speed she could still achieve was significantly less than normal. So that is certainly something to also keep in mind when we look at the other ships that we still have in there, because they will have similar challenges.
Now, summer is approaching, with temperatures in the Middle East can horrifically high. Assuming, well, let's hope Project Freedom does work, but if it doesn't, are you now having to consider maybe putting those ships into some form of layup and getting the crew off because the temperature, it might be just so unpleasant being on board?
I think we would never rule anything out, you know, and in these cases, we also see the summer coming. We are probably still cautiously optimistic that over the next 4 to 6 weeks, we'll see some opportunities to get the ships out. If that would not happen, yeah, then of course, we also have to look at other options. Yeah. And indeed, you were right. I mean, worst case, you would have to lay up the ships, yeah, like it was in the Suez Canal in, 1974, I think, or 67, I don't recall exactly. Yeah.
I suspect the Persian Gulf is not the best place you'd choose for laying up a ship if you had to, but you have no choice, obviously. How many, before this started, obviously you were shipping thousands of containers into the region. They'd probably presumably been offloaded all over the place. How many containers do you now have stranded in other ports? And who is then responsible for the cost of getting them to their final destination? Is that you? Is it your customers? The insurers?
I think there's different ways to handle that. We all together had about 15,000 shipments and between 40 and 50,000 TUs of cargo stuck. I know that some of our peers then decided to declare end of voyage, which in essence means you hand over the responsibility to the customer. We decided to work with our customers and try to find ways to either return the cargo or try to find alternative ways to get it to final destination, or in some cases, bring it somewhere else. And our teams have worked tirelessly over the last weeks to try and get that organized. And I was very pleased to see last week that I think we have now for close to 95% of the cargo that got stuck. We now know where we need to bring it. And we found routings for them. And most of it is meantime also being moved. Of course, that costs a lot of money. Yeah, and the initial cost was borne by us. Yeah, but of course, we also think that in dialogue with customers, it's fair that everybody takes his fair share of these costs. So that means a part of it also gets charged to customers, for example, stuff related to storage or on forwarding or additional moves that need to be made. I would say that on the whole, I think customers have very much welcomed that approach. I'm very pleased with the way that we have handled that, but it has been an incredible amount of work over a long period of time by quite a large number of people.
I can well imagine. I assume there's still cargo on the ships that are stuck in the Persian Gulf. Does that include refrigerated cargoes or perishables? And if so, can you keep those in good condition, or is it just a matter of them having to be dumped in the end?
It depends, of course, a little bit on the goods that are on there. I mean, yes, there is some refrigerated cargo on there. Luckily, not too much, because most of that had been discharged before things started. But what we'll try to do is we'll try to keep it as good as we can. But it's very clear that some of the perishable cargo, as it says, yeah, is no longer good after 6 or 8 weeks. Having said that, the vast majority of the goods that we have on board of the ships are, of course, normal general cargo, and that should still be in good condition.
Now, one of the things that I wanted to ask you was about looking at the maritime fleet in general. Because of the disruption to oil flows, are there sufficient bunker supplies? Can you get your ships fueled? Is it oil, LNG? Are you able to get what you need for your other ships in the fleet?
So far, that has not been a problem. Of course, it's a problem because it's so much more expensive. I mean, today we pay about $50, $60 million a week more for bunker than we did prior to the crisis. So that's a huge problem. But supply so far has not been an issue. I know there have been a number of reports on especially kerosene, but that's likely going to be the fuel that's going to be scarce earlier, or the earliest. I think that when you look at bunker fuel, which is in essence is the lowest grade product that's being made out of oil, I think that it will take some time before that becomes scarce. And then in addition to that, we, of course, have the benefit as liner companies that we typically bunker in the bigger bunker ports, and that's where supply will be available, at least for the foreseeable future. The only thing we do at the moment to ensure that we don't run out of fuel is that we typically take in a little bit more bunker than we would do normally, and so that we have a bit more safety stock on board.
What about LNG? Are you burning LNG on your ships?
We are burning LNG on some of our ships, but there we also make the trade-off between, what's the cost of low sulfur fuel and what's the cost of LNG. And that means that the number of ships that's running actively on LNG at the moment is only a few.
So when you've got dual fuel ships, can you switch back and forth easily?
Yes, that's actually quite easy. No, it's not that takes a day or so. It's not just a flip of a switch, but it's not something that cannot be done. I think within an hour or two, one can change from one fuel type to another.
Now, you just mentioned about prices going up of fuel, but overall, can you say how this crisis is affecting your costs, not just in fuel, but maybe charter costs, insurance premiums, lost revenue?
Well, I think for us, there's probably four main impacts. On the revenue side, as you say, rightfully, I mean, we miss out on 15, 20,000 TEUs a week. That's a lot, yeah, if you take into account an average revenue for that type of cargo of probably $1,000 a TEU, all inclusive. I mean, that's 15 to 20 million revenue that we are missing. So that's a problem. I think then we have, of course, the fuel, which if you look at it today is probably between $300 and $400 a ton more expensive than it was before. As we bunker over 100,000 tons a week, that gets you easily to the 50 million that I mentioned before. Insurance premiums are up, although admittedly mainly for the ships that are in or near the war zone. And then we've had also a fair bit of additional storage costs because of the boxes that we talked about earlier that got stuck left, right, and center. I would say that especially in March and in April, that cost us also about $1 million a day, which of course is not a small sum of money if you add it up. And I think contrary to what we've seen in previous crises, the special thing about the crisis in the Strait of Hormuz is that whilst it's a very isolated event, and as such, the impact on the overall network is not so big, the impact on overall cost is huge because, you know, the higher fuel price especially impacts us everywhere. And of course, the fuel price does not only impact our fuel cost, but it also impacts our feeder cost, it impacts the rail cost, it impacts the trucking cost. So that's why this crisis is a little bit special and very different to, for example, what we saw in COVID or what we saw around Suez or the lack of water in the Panama Canal.
On the other side, obviously, you've imposed surcharges on your customers. I presume freight rates must have gone up. How has that balanced out the rising costs and how have your customers responded?
I mean, customers are never happy, you know, when costs go up. I think most people understand, though, that the fuel prices have gone up. I mean, if you go to the petrol station, you also have to pay more. And it's a little bit the same here. So I think as far as fuel is concerned, most people have understood that those costs have gone up. In many cases, we also see that that's being regulated through our marine fuel recovery mechanism, although that has normally a delay of a couple of months. We tried to pull that forward simply because we can't sustain that additional cash outflow of $50 or $60 million a month. When it's around other costs, you typically have more debate. And one should also not forget that when it's around those contractual arrangements, that's only for the cargo that goes on long-term contracts, which is roughly 50% of our business. The rest is dependent on spot rates. And we have seen that spot rates have been sort of flattish, maybe a little bit up, but not necessarily enough to recover the additional fuel costs that we incur. So all in all, I think it's not easy for us to recover that additional cost. And I think at the moment, we're still not recovering all of that. There's also something to do with the season. I mean, between Chinese New Year and before we go into summer is typically the slack season where rates are anyway under pressure. So that combination of slack season and significantly higher, especially fuel costs around the globe, that's not a great combination for us at this point in time.
But you'll be approaching the higher season now and you've just finished the Trans-Pacific contracting season. So were you able to get higher prices on the Transpac, even though that's not directly impacted by the Strait of Hormuz? But this is a global market, isn't it? So were you able to get higher prices on your contract rates?
I mean, a lot of that was already concluded before the crisis really hit. So I think in the end, we will, through those contracts, be able to recover our higher fuel costs. So I think that is positive. If you look at the rates, excluding fuel, I think they were sort of flattish, yeah, year on year. Also because the Trans-Pacific and in general, the trades in and out of the US have not been the ones that have been carrying global growth over the last 2 years.
So in the past, crises, I'm thinking particularly of COVID pandemic, shipping lines actually benefited in the end. Would you say this is different? Would you say the long-term results of this will not be beneficial?
I mean, if I would have to bet right now, then I don't think that the long-term effects of this will be very beneficial, simply because you have a relatively isolated incident in the Strait of Hormuz, which impacts 5 to 7% of the global flow. but you have a cost effect that actually impacts 100% of what happens around the globe. So the cost effect in this case is much more extreme than it was in the past, when you also saw some effects. I mean, if you take COVID, there initially fuel prices plummeted because there was very low demand. And then we saw very high demand across the globe, which drove really prices up to very high levels. And also when you look at the situation that we saw around Suez, for example, that had also a much broader impact because it impacted all the traffic into the Mediterranean, into Europe, North Continent, and a significant chunk of the traffic that went to the US as well. So it covered a lot more cargo than in this case. And that's why I think in this time it is potentially going to be different.
Now, we mentioned Project Freedom earlier. We don't really know how that's going to play out, but Iran has talked about charging tolls. Would you be prepared to pay tolls if that was the only way to get your ships out?
I mean, for now, it's illegal to pay those tolls when you look at all kinds of sanctions that are in there. I also believe that it would be fundamentally wrong to start charging tolls for passing somewhere through international water. So I sincerely hope that that is not going to be the outcome. I think when you look at tolls like we see them in the Suez Canal or in the Panama Canal, I have some sympathy for that because that's where people did gigantic infrastructural works, yeah, in order to facilitate a more efficient shipping industry. That is not the case in the Strait of Hormuz, nor in a number of all other smaller passages. So it would be totally wrong to even discuss tolls for something like that.
Now, if the Strait of Hormuz is opened, or when it opens, reopens, how long will it take, do you think, A, to get the ships out, because presumably it has to be some sort of coordinated effort, and how before markets then sort of return to a new normal?
Well, I think that people would be able to get the ships out fairly quickly. I think if the Strait of Hormuz will open today, then my guesstimate would be that the vast majority of the ships is out within a week. The more challenging question is, how long will it take before things then return to normal? Because a lot of services have been suspended, a lot of ships have been deployed in other trades around the globe, so that would all have to be put back. I think that before we would have a normal flow of goods again in and out of the Gulf, that will probably take, best case, 2 months, more realistically, probably between 3 to 4 months. Keep in mind that, for example, stuff that comes from Asia, first the ship needs to go to Asia, then the goods need to be booked, they need to be loaded, and then we need to sail all the way into the Gulf. So doing that within 3 months is already a stretch.
And has this crisis made you have a look at your whole network and perhaps try to reduce exposure to both this and other choke points and bottlenecks and sort of diversify, spread the risk, really?
Well, I think this crisis has actually shown that our network is pretty resilient because the impact on the rest of the network has been very limited. And that's where I think the setup that we've chosen with our hub and spoke network in Gemini together with Maersk has proven to be, again, a pretty robust structure. I don't think we would be able to change much to our network, to be honest, because if we want to serve the countries in the upper Gulf, one has to go through the Strait. There is simply no other way. And the land bridges that have currently been established are A, lacking capacity, and B, are just way too expensive. So I think that in this particular case, this will not result in a significantly different network. It underlines, though, that having something which is a bit more hub and spoke is definitely more resilient than something where you only go point to point.
So what do you see as the long-term consequences of this crisis? It sounds to me as if you think they may not be anything too long-term, but has it changed anything, assuming this does get resolved fairly soon? Has it changed anything in the way you run your business, run the network? And do you think it's going to have an impact on recruitment of seafarers? Because they've had a pretty rough time in recent years, haven't they?
Well, I think the last point you mentioned is probably the most relevant one. I think the seafarers, if you see what they've all had to endure over the last 5-6 years, that's really not funny. And of course, that doesn't make people more excited about that job. So we need to make sure that we continue to do whatever is in our ability to also emphasize the positive things that there are around the life as a seafarer. So far, over the last years, we have still been able to attract seafarers, and I hope that that's also going to be the case in the future. But I think it just underlines what a crucial role they play in the industry, and that we need to do whatever we can to make life as good as possible for them. As far as the other points you made around, does it change something in the way that we run our business? I don't think it changes all that much. Also, because the reason that I mentioned before, which is that I think that our network has actually proven to be quite resilient, and we've been able to isolate the impact of this specific crisis quite well and without too much difficulty. And we've also been able to continue to serve our customers, even those that had their cargo stuck because of what happened here. So I think if anything, in this case, I think it reinforces our business model. So I don't think we're going to change a whole lot. Yeah.
Rolf, as well as having the Strait of Hormuz closed, you also have been having to go around Africa because of closure of the Suez Canal. Had you started to return to the Suez Canal, or was that still out of bounds as far as you're concerned?
We looked at returning to Suez in the beginning of the year together with our Germany partner, Maersk. I think we did a couple of sailings where we went through, also because we had close protection at that point in time. That was no longer available after that. And then we decided to go again around the Cape. If you look at the situation as we see it today, it's certainly not more stable than a few months ago. So unfortunately, I would think that a return to Suez is still going to take a while. But we've also learned that things can change very, very rapidly. I would not be surprised that if the situation in the Strait gets resolved, that fairly soon thereafter, we will also start looking again at returning to Suez. But all of that for now is a bit up in the air. I think when the whole crisis around almost started, everybody thought this was going to be a matter of days or weeks. Meantime, we're in it for a couple of months. As we said before in this podcast, we think that in order to return to normal, even if it gets resolved fast, will take us several months. Realistically, we will only after that then start looking at returning to Suez. So I don't think we are going to see that before the peak season of 2026. I would like to think that we can have a gradual return to Suez after the peak season, so that we get back to a fully normal network by the beginning of 2027. But whether that is feasible or not, that's unfortunately a little bit too early to tell. But if you ask me, that would probably at the moment be my best guess.
And we're also now hearing that Somali piracy has made a resurgence. Now, I don't think that affects container ships quite so much, but nevertheless, is that something else that you're thinking about or monitoring?
I mean, we're trying to monitor all these factors. In the end, it will never be entirely quiet. Right now, I think priority one is the Strait of Hormuz because, yes, we sail around Africa, but at least all those supply chains are intact and stable at the moment. As soon as Hormuz is resolved, I'm sure that our attention will get back to Suez. But as I just said a few minutes ago, if we return to Suez, we will only do it step by step by step. Also because we need to prevent the ports in the Med and in North Europe to collapse, because all of a sudden we have two or three ships from every service arriving in a week rather than just one.
And final question, if you did go back through Suez, would you be prepared to have armed guards on your ships to guard them?
I mean, we would not talk about specific measures that we would take, but rest assured that we would take every possible measure that is needed in order to maximize the safety for our crews.
Thank you.
You're welcome.
Straight Talk with Rolf Habben-Jansen.